Trump was asked about Ukraine during his first cabinet meeting.
Mr. President, Ukraine, can you talk a little bit about what type of security guarantees you're willing to make?
Well, I'm not going to make security guarantees beyond very much. We're going to have Europe do that because it's in, you know, we're talking about Europe as their next door neighbor. But we're going to make sure everything goes well. And as you know, we'll be making a we'll be really partnering with Ukraine in terms of rare earth. We very much need rare earth. They have great rare earth. We'll be working with Secretary Burgum and with Chris. You'll be working on that together.
Bronco Marchetich, your final comment. We just have 30 seconds.
You know, I think this continues the plundering of Ukraine that has been going on. It's been bipartisan policy for years now. To use deepening U.S. military involvement in the country and economic dependence on the United States as a way to get Ukraine to do a host of damaging neoliberal reforms that are contrary to the interests of the actual Ukrainian people. And this is just, you know, again, it's that on overdrive.
Bronco Marchetich, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Jacobin staff writer speaking to us from Chicago. We'll link to all your recent articles at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Nina Gesder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warner, Trina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, preventing suicides among local kids. Some say a vital program that does this is now on the budget chopping block. Washington state lawmakers are looking at extending the right to vote to those in jails and prisons. And an Oregon lawmaker warns Trump's tariff plans will be devastating for many businesses, including the state's valuable hazelnut crop. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 27, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Oregon's largest county, like many communities across the country, is coping with a big budget deficit and possible federal funding cuts. At the same time, local leaders are trying to find ways to trim spending, provoking backlash in many cases. One of those cases is school-based mental health, which supporters say prevents children's suicides. Multnomah County commissioners heard from several people today who say these programs are critical and must be spared from the budget axe.
My name is Francis Flores Tapia. I am a proud Spanish-speaking Latina who serves as a clinician for the county's school-based mental health program. I'd like to address the confusing and shocking proposal to terminate school-based mental health services. I use those words because I know mental health matters to you, and yet here we are. I'm aware of the budget cuts, and I know you've got a lot on your plate. I empathize with you because I, too, tend to have a lot on my plate. On a regular basis, as a school-based mental health clinician, I screen for suicide risk and intervene when children disclose they'd like to or already have attempted suicide. I intervene when children are self-harming and cutting a little too deep, or when they're using substances and engaging in risky behaviors. I support children who are in crisis because they're finally disclosing to someone that abuse, sexual assault, or domestic violence has occurred, and they're scared for their safety. Or they've gotten to the point where they want to hurt someone else and are on the verge of being expelled because of their behaviors. I help intervene when I learn that a child is attempting to run away without a housing option in mind, or when a youth is withholding from eating and on the verge of being hospitalized. I support so many newly arrived immigrant youth who are missing their homes and families, isolated because they're still learning English, and terrified of deportation. I think it's important to remind everyone what school-based mental health does to keep youth and our community safe. 26 clinicians across 6 school districts do these things and so much more on a regular basis. I also say this as a warning of the catastrophic ripple effects that the removal of the safety net could have on so many vulnerable youth who may not qualify for services elsewhere. Our clients and families are terrified about losing these services.
My name's Amanda Cord. I'm a nurse practitioner at the Franklin Student Health Center. I just wanted to tell you about a kid that Kate and I see. Kate is the school-based mental health provider at my school. She's a young Black woman. She has a history of early childhood trauma, ADHD, and things were not going well at school, behaviorally, academically, socially. The school social worker referred her to our clinic because he knew we have a robust team of mental health and medical services. Erica wasn't open to the idea of mental health services, but she came in for a different issue. And once she was there, I asked if she maybe wanted to talk about what was going on, and she wasn't sure. She had a hard time trusting people, which is pretty understandable. So I grabbed Kate, and she came into the room, and she met Erica, and that moment made the difference for Erica to be able to actually feel safe to come to that first appointment. Every week, Kate meets with the school counselors and school social workers to update them on who's on her caseload so they know who's being seen. And information about how that kid is doing in the school, academic and behavioral concerns, high flyers, what's going on in the school within FERPA and HIP and everything, obviously. But working closely with the school, Kate was able to get this kid the academic support that she needed and the social support. When Erica got a boyfriend, Kate sent her back to me to talk about birth control, and she and I both spent time talking and listening to help her make decisions about the rest of her life. And being able to communicate with each other helped us to provide consistent, respectful support with these really big decisions. Erica has lived with several different family members, and throughout that time, Kate has been working with her, accessing her strengths through art therapy, trauma-focused therapy, and I've seen her blossom into a confident, calm, and self-possessed young woman. If it weren't for Kate, Erica's story would have been very different.
I'm Wendy Foster. I'm here today to speak as a nearly 20-year employee in the school-based mental health program, which is slated to be completely eliminated in the current proposed budget. I brought with me a gift from a client that I store in the same fireproof box where I keep my passport and daughter's birth certificate. A student came to me, and within an hour of meeting her, I assessed her as being at high risk for suicide. I called her parents, who brought her to the ER, where she was admitted to the adolescent psychiatric unit. She kept an art journal of her progress, and after several months, came back to give it to me, telling me, if you hadn't been there, I'm not sure I would still be here. So now, no one like me will be there, who can see a student quickly without having to make sure they have some sort of guaranteed payment prior. No one will be there to see undocumented students who cannot get any insurance coverage and are afraid to go anywhere else besides school. No one will be there in Far East County, my current location, or services are sparse, if they exist at all. We are placed in the schools, but our work can take us to other places in the community. I've been to juvenile court after one of my clients was arrested while her mother and I were scrambling to find an inpatient placement.
Multnomah County Commissioners will be finalizing their budget over the next several months. President Trump and the Republican majority in Congress are building out a federal budget with big cuts, and they include federal funding for housing and homelessness programs in Oregon. Oregon gets more than $711 million each year to help build affordable housing and help homeless Oregonians. That's a big number, but even current funding levels don't meet the need. A big chunk, almost $600 million, goes toward rental assistance. And only about one in four people who need rental assistance to stay in their home end up getting federal help. Federal money also goes toward emergency housing vouchers, programs to build or fix up affordable housing, and nonprofits that serve homeless people. Funding could be cut program by program, like the National Housing Trust Fund, Home Investments, Emergency Solutions Grants, or Continuum of Care. But they could also be cut more indirectly, like if they're converted into block grants, a process that Republicans have touted as a way to reduce costs in the past. In reality, they often transfer administrative costs to states and result in less oversight and clear results. Block grants are also less responsive to people's needs than other program structures compared to the flexibility of other types of programs like Medicaid and SNAP. Programs could also be impacted if Congress changes the eligibility qualifications for these programs that support low-income Americans. Oregon lawmakers in Salem are proceeding with caution and looking at belt-tightening measures for the state's spending since there is so much uncertainty. Oregon Congresswoman Andrea Salinas is among lawmakers earning a perfect score this year from the League of Conservation Voters. This week, she spoke out about several environmental issues on her mind.
I think folks know now more than ever, we have to stand up against the Republicans' effort to set us back decades in the fight against climate change. President Trump wants to, quote, unleash American energy dominance with the tried and failed drill baby drill approach that ignores the realities of climate change, and it ignores the economic realities that renewables are not only good for the planet, they're also the cheapest source of energy. Republicans in Congress want us to focus on rolling back energy efficiency standards for household appliances, standards which would actually reduce energy consumption and save consumers money, instead of engaging on forward-thinking energy and environmental policies. They also want to use climate disasters like wildfires to justify rolling back bedrock environmental protections and pave the way for unrestrained exploitation of our natural resources. There are smart ways to expand our electric grid and manage our forests, build more housing, and deploy new technologies. And then there's the Republican way. We are going to see more and more attacks over the next 4 years, and we all need to work closer than ever to defend our environment. So I'm continuing to work on the House Ag Committee to pass a farm bill that protects investments in conservation and climate smart agriculture. I'm really proud to be the ranking member on the Forestry and Horticulture Subcommittee, where I want to continue to do the good work of finding that nexus where we can protect our forests and move our climate forward, make sure that wildfires are addressed. Our caucus is also using every bit of leverage we have to push back on Republicans' efforts to claw back critical environment and clean energy investments that we made under the Biden administration to pay for tax breaks for billionaires and corporations. This is not the direction we should be going. LCV's scorecard is a critical tool to hold my colleagues and myself accountable to our constituents, ensuring we don't lose track of the bigger picture for our environment and climate as we address the day-to-day challenges facing Americans. And Lord knows they are throwing all of it at us all at once right now. So that scorecard also plays an important role in tracking and assessing the full scope of Republican attacks on environmental protections, and thus sets the framework for our work ahead when we retake the majority. And I look forward to that in 2 years.
Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden announced he's opposing another nominee for President Trump's team. And he also warned other senators about the impact of Trump's tariffs on inflation and trade.
The nomination of Jameson Greer to serve as United States Trade Representative. He'd be the top official on one of the president's signature issues, trade and tariffs. Donald Trump was elected president largely on the promise of lowering prices for American families and remaking the global economy to America's benefit. What he has shown is a willingness to impose staggering costs on our families, workers, and businesses in order to settle scores on issues that have nothing to do with trade or the economy. He gets headlines, his wealthy friends get tax breaks, and American families get stuck with higher prices and bigger bills. I oppose this nomination, and I certainly have nothing against Mr. Greer personally. I just believe in this position, he'll be a rubber stamp for the Trump tax. The knee-jerk decision to slap tariffs on nearly everything Americans buy and make high prices even higher. Mr. Greer has embraced the Trump chaos strategy, which is a slap in the face to farmers, manufacturers, and communities across the country. The Trump administration's across-the-board tariffs are going to cost Americans big time, up to $2,600 a year, according to one estimate. That could devastate American jobs. One appraisal is destroy 344,000 American jobs. Donald Trump has already ordered tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China. The China tariffs went into effect last month. Now he's promising that 25% tariffs on everything Americans buy from Mexico and Canada would go into effect next week. Get ready for gas prices to go up, power prices to spike, auto supply chains to be thrown out of whack, and fresh fruit and vegetables getting more expensive. Donald Trump has promised new tariffs on steel and aluminum, which go into everything from soda cans to cars. He proposed tariffs on copper, which is used in everything from housing to medical devices and cars. They largely come from Chile and Canada. The only thing we can be sure about with Trump tariffs is that they're going to hit working Americans the hardest. And if you ask people at a Fred Meyer store in Gresham, Oregon, or buying groceries in Charlotte or Kalamazoo, they don't need an economist to know that Donald Trump isn't helping prices. Less than a third of Americans approve of the job Donald Trump is doing on inflation, according to a poll released this week. Consumer sentiment, a particularly important measure, fell by 10% this month. More and more Americans are rightly worried that tariffs are going to drive more inflation. If this trade war continues, there's no doubt many U.S. workers, farmers, and ranchers are going to lose their jobs when our trading partners retaliate and slap tariffs on made-in-the-USA products. That's what happened the last time Donald Trump was in office. American producers of everything from rice to bourbon to motorcycles got hammered. They sold less overseas, made less money, and workers ended up paying the price. There is a right way to approach tariffs that punishes bad actors like China and targets the products that will change other countries' behavior while minimizing the cost to American families. The Trump administration is doing the opposite. He's maximizing price spikes for regular Americans with no plan or strategy. So one other point with respect to trade chaos. Mr. Greer has endorsed this, and it's already hurting farmers and small business. I had four town hall meetings in my state recently and talked with lots of small business and farmers. I'm hearing one message over and over again. They are already losing sales and losing markets. Last year, our state exported $34 billion in blueberries, hazelnuts, and other goods overseas, almost an all-time high. Now, instead of building on that success, our producers and innovators prepare for the worst. The Washington Post quoted an Iowa farmer who's seen prices of seed, fertilizers, and equipment increase while prices for soybeans are flat. Our goal is to make Iowa and U.S. soybean farms profitable, said this Iowa farmer. And to do that, we need the international markets. The state economist in Georgia said the greatest threat to the economy is Trump's trade threats. Tariffs mean higher prices for consumers, while trade wars mean other countries buy less of what Georgia makes, including aerospace components, pulp and paper, machinery, and auto parts. It's bad for American workers. There are similar reports of communities fearing the worst in Wisconsin, North Carolina, and across the land.
Another Trump nominee who just barely won confirmation in the U.S. Senate is Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. As Eric Tegedoff reports, there are links between Hegseth and an Idaho church with extreme views and rules.
Hegseth is part of a church associated with the Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches, founded by Doug Wilson in Moscow, Idaho in the 1970s. The church holds extreme beliefs, including that the United States should follow biblical law. Julie Ingersoll is a religious studies professor at the University of North Florida who has studied Christian Reconstructionists like Wilson. She says Hegseth's church is not like a megachurch in which you walk in and think of yourself as a member.
In order to join, you have to attest to believing the same things. And in order to remain a member, you have to continue to believe those things.
Ingersoll says membership is strict, and if people's beliefs change, they can be brought before the church courts on heresy charges. Wilson began his movement in part because he found a lack of sufficient Christian school options for his daughter. The Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches has congregations in almost all 50 states and holds other extreme views, such as criminalization of people in the LGBTQ community. They're also deeply patriarchal, which Ingersoll says is a label the church itself uses, with some arguing that women shouldn't have the right to vote. Ingersoll notes that Hegseth backtracked during his confirmation hearing on whether women should serve in the military.
He kind of switched it in a soft way to not believing that women should be in combat. And that gives a flexibility to allow people to hear what he's saying and go, oh yeah, maybe that's not a terrible thing.
In 2020, Hegseth published a book that mischaracterized the Islamic faith and positioned Muslims as historic enemies of the West. Ingersoll says this belief also flows from the church of which he belongs.
For him, Islam and all other world religions and all other ideological systems, all isms, flow out of original sin in the Garden of Eden, because they're all based in this idea that humans can reason apart from God.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, then at 7, American Indian Airways. Tonight's weather, a few passing clouds, a low of 41. Tomorrow's weather, morning clouds give way to sunny skies by afternoon, a high near 65. Today in history, on this date in 1922, the U.S. Supreme Court defended women's voting rights in the case of Lesser versus Garnett, upholding the constitutionality of the 19th Amendment, which, when ratified 2 years earlier, provided American women with the right to vote. Our quote of the day is from Susan B. Anthony. Organize, agitate, educate must be our war cry. Washington State's lawmakers are weighing voting rights for incarcerated people. Two bills in the state capitol in Olympia aim to extend the ability to vote to those in jails and prisons. Isabel Charlet reports. Voting rights groups say everyone is a constituent and deserves the right to vote.
More than 14,000 incarcerated people in Washington are not able to vote. One bill would make voting more accessible for people in jail by improving access to the voter's pamphlet and voter registration forms. Another bill would allow people in prison in Washington to vote for the first time in the state's history. Charles Longshore is incarcerated at the Washington Correction Center for Men in Shelton.
I've helped draft a bill that's before the legislature this session, and leading several other bills, but I find that it's difficult because you have no reason to be accountable to me.
Longshore is a Skokomish tribal member and says giving the vote to incarcerated people would help right historical wrongs against Indigenous people who were not given the full right to vote until 1965. Data shows Native Americans are vastly overrepresented in the criminal legal system. Opponents of allowing people to vote from prison say voting is a privilege and that breaking laws should mean you lose your voice. Anthony Blankenship with Civil Survival says everyone is a constituent, whether they get to choose who represents them or not. He says allowing incarcerated people to vote will help with their rehabilitation.
We have to be able to see and understand what they need to be successful and what they need to not go back to prison or harm anyone ever again.
Blankenship says it is unlikely these bills will pass this session, but that it is important to keep raising the issue.
We have to keep on pushing. We have to keep on saying that these are opportunities for people to be part of our community and not be on the outside looking in.
Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
The U.S. House has passed a controversial budget outline that would make steep cuts to Medicaid. Elon Musk attends President Trump's first cabinet meeting. And federal workers leave jobs despite litigation allowing them to stay. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
We are going to deliver the America First agenda. We're going to deliver all of it, not just parts of it. And this was the first step in that process.
Speaker of the House Mike Johnson was able to corral just enough votes to advance a budget to the Senate. Infighting among Republicans almost kept it from passing. No House Democrat voted for it, and the only Republican voting no was Thomas Massie of Kentucky. The spending outline calls for $2 trillion in cuts to safety net programs to pay for extending tax cuts that mostly go to corporations and the wealthiest households. Congress has to act in 2 weeks to avoid a government shutdown. This comes amid continuing confusion among government workers about their employment status. While the Department of Government Efficiency has been causing chaos, that advisory group's leader Elon Musk is downplaying his part. He described himself as nothing more than tech support at President Donald Trump's first cabinet meeting and says he's just working to cut the deficit.
We simply cannot sustain a $2 trillion deficit. Just the interest on the national debt now exceeds the Defense Department's spending.
A new Office of Personnel Management memo calls for agencies to submit a plan for cutting more jobs by March 3rd. By mid-April, agencies must offer a management reorganization plan and move certain positions out of Washington, D.C. That's likely to be challenged in court, and a lawsuit aims to halt the dismissal of probationary government workers. Unions and nonprofits want thousands of federal employees to keep their jobs while the suit is litigated. A key battle looks likely to be Republicans' plans to cut Medicaid, which they say is riddled with fraud. State officials say the federally funded state-run program that covers low-income families and people with disabilities is actually much more cost-efficient than private health care. They say without it, millions of pregnant people and rural folks would lose coverage. Nevada Senate Majority Leader Democrat Nicole Cannizzaro says the cuts would cause chaos and cost the state billions.
Any Republican tax bill that cuts Medicaid or other essential funding for Nevadans should be at the top of the list to say no to. Republicans only have a very small majority in the U.S. House, and one courageous Republican could likely stop any Medicaid cuts from happening.
She's pushing her Republican colleagues to vote no, but Republican Nevada Congressman Marco Modi praises it for prioritizing border security, national defense, and domestic energy production. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Latino leaders have organized a boycott for tomorrow for national retailers who are eliminating or rolling back their diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, programs. Roz Brown reports they're calling it Latino Freeze Day, and they're targeting specific American brands.
The diversity, equity, and inclusion framework has been a cornerstone for many large retailers for several decades. But attacks by President Donald Trump and the GOP in general have led such giants as Walmart, Target, McDonald's, and others to scale back their DEI initiatives. San Jose State University professor Caroline Sao Chen says one person might not be able to make a huge difference, but if 20% of people joined Latino Freeze Day, the impact would be substantial.
Telling those companies, we do not approve of what you are doing, and we will take our money and we will spend it elsewhere.
The annual purchasing power of Latinos in the U.S. continues to grow, now topping more than $3 trillion. DEI programs have been around since the 1960s and are meant to promote the fair treatment and full participation of all people, particularly groups historically underrepresented or subject to discrimination. As an Asian woman, Xiao Chen says she knows what that's like, but adds that Friday's boycott would need to be just the beginning.
You can't make this just February 28th. In order to make any sort of significant economic impact to any of these retailers, it is going to have to be for an extended period of time.
This is Roz Brown.
National parks across the West are bracing for their busy season, even as they're losing staff from the Trump administration's firings to reduce the federal workforce. As Suzanne Potter reports, a judge in San Francisco is hearing an important lawsuit about the firings of probationary federal employees today.
A coalition of unions and nonprofits is asking that thousands of federal workers be able to stay on the job while the matter is litigated. Retired Yosemite Superintendent Don Neubacher works with the coalition to protect America's national parks. He says civil servants deserve better treatment.
They were told they were fired because they were bad employees, but the evidence so far is just the opposite. They were good employees, and it was just an excuse. So we believe it was an illegal firing.
The Trump administration doubled down, indicating it will now seek to lay off people with civil service protections in order to cut costs. A new memo from the Office of Personnel Management instructs agencies to submit a plan for a reduction in force by March 13th. By mid-April, agencies must offer a plan to reorganize management and move certain jobs out of Washington, D.C. Neubacher says the chainsaw approach is counterproductive.
This is just chaos. The National Park Service probably has the lowest morale that I've ever seen, and I worked 36 years. So it's overall just crippling.
A dozen groups are party to the lawsuit, including the American Federation of Government Employees, Vote Vets, and the United Nurses Association of California. I'm Suzanne Potter.
A lawmaker in California is laying out some plans to fight the tragedy of missing and murdered indigenous people, and some observers say an Alaska volcano is showing signs of life. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez and National Native News.
California Assemblymember James Ramos's legislative package includes continued efforts to address missing and murdered indigenous people in the state. He spoke at a MMIP Tribal Policy Summit in Paula, California. Ramos highlighted the Feather Alert system in its second year being used in the state to notify the public and law enforcement about missing Native Americans. He's the first and only California Native American currently serving.
Being in the state legislature and with all your support, we've been able to start to bring pieces of legislation forward that focuses on the Department of Justice to start to build that statistical data so that we go out and we ask for resources, that data is there, something that hasn't been there for California Indian people. We continue gaining allies in the state legislature and within law enforcement to bring forward the issue of missing and murdered indigenous women.
One of his bills, AB 31, authorizes the State Department of Justice to grant tribal police from three California tribes state peace officer status if they meet the same requirements and standards as other police officers in the state. It would also assist law enforcement by clarifying jurisdiction and permitting tribal police to assist communities close to reservations. Officials are keeping a close eye on a volcano near Anchorage, Alaska, for chances of eruption. KNBA's Jill Freitas has more.
According to the Alaska Volcano Observatory, Mount Spur, located about 80 miles west of the city, has shown signs of heightened activity. This has promoted the elevation of the alert level to watch, which increases the potential for an eruption. David Schneider is a research geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey Alaska Volcano Observatory.
We increased our alert level back in October of last year, increasing the aviation color code as well as the volcano alert level to yellow for aviation and advisory for ground hazards.
The advisory comes after increased seismic activity and minor ash emissions observed over the past few months.
The volcano is either going to erupt or it's not. There's no escalating trend where the volcano is presenting this could go on and it could die away and no eruption. So we're in that stage right now of just watching what the volcano is going to do.
Mount Spur last erupted in 1992, sending ash as high as 65,000 feet and causing disruptions to air travel and local communities.
We're in the preparedness stage, which is a good place for people to be, both as scientists and an observatory, to reaching out to emergency managers, segments of the economy that might be impacted, like the airport, and just making sure we're all on the same page.
Schneider wants to remind the public that a possible volcanic eruption is just another natural hazard to be prepared for in Alaska.
Living in Alaska, we should all have some basic level of preparedness for natural hazards. We have windstorms that knock out power for days at a time. We have earthquakes that can happen. So we're kind of used to that level of preparedness. So for volcanic ash, it's really not a whole lot different than being ready for any other natural hazard.
I'm Jill Freitas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 27th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Ken Jones. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
Up KBOO.
Join me, Melissa Lesniak, creator and host of That Vegan Show, this Friday, February 28th at 11 a.m., where I interview two of the founders of Ratway Sanctuary, Lionel and Laura. They tell us about the rats they care for, and also we get to hear stories about Alice and Paige, some of the special rats that have been in their care. So tune in February 28th at 11 a.m. to hear That Vegan.